It's Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori on The Fan. Sports Radio 101.9 FM and Sports Radio 66, WFAN and WFAN-FM, New York.
Wow, good morning and welcome to Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori on this Sunday, May 8th. Happy Mother's Day. Be sure to give your mom a lot of love and appreciation today and always. Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori is brought to you by Travelers. It's better under the umbrella. And speaking of Travelers, the Travelers Championship at TPC River Highlands in Cromwell, Connecticut, just outside of Hartford, quickly approaching June 23rd to the 26th, a week after the U.S. Open, which will be played at the Country Club in Brookline, Massachusetts. And both the U.S. Open and the Travelers Championship hosted their media days this past week. And the LPGA Founders Cup, which takes place this coming Thursday through Sunday at Upper Montclair Country Club in Clifton, New Jersey. They hosted their media day this past Thursday as well. And yes, I was happy to play in all of these media days. And, you know, it sounds like tough duty, but these media days give us a lot of information about the course and the tournaments, and it's great to play these courses. Lots of fun, obviously, but most importantly, they all do a great job at previewing their championships, providing a lot of information to get us ready to talk about the tournaments. And I always think playing the course before you talk about it and watch it is really key in understanding the difficulties and the challenges of the layout and what the professionals have to focus on to win it. So this morning, we're going to cover a lot of ground. In a moment, you will hear my conversation with Anna Davis, the 16-year-old high school sophomore who won the Augusta National Women's Am. She's been granted a sponsor's exemption to play in the Founders Cup, which is coming up on Thursday, as I mentioned. And then, of course, the U.S. Open Championship taking place at the Country Club. Just fascinated with the golf history there. And I will be talking about that with Jeff Hall, who's in charge of everything inside the ropes for the USGA at the U.S. Open. And then Nathan Grube, the tournament director of the Travelers Championship, will join us at about 7:40 this morning to preview this popular PGA Tour event. So a lot going on. Well, let's go right to the interview with Anna Davis, who will be playing in the LPGA Founders Cup that starts on Thursday. Welcome back to Talking Golf with Ann Liguori, and my guest is Anna Davis, who is the winner of the Augusta National Women's Amateur. Anna, congratulations. I was there at Augusta National for 10 days. I saw your win. What an incredible accomplishment.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So how has your life changed since then?
It's been pretty hectic these past few weeks for sure. Gotten a bunch of sponsor exemptions and huge opportunities, and so I'm looking forward to the few weeks coming up.
You're handling all the attention great. It's like, you know, you're taking it like you're used to it.
Yeah. I'm a pretty calm person, so I try to take these things pretty I'm pretty chill, so I can take them.
You are pretty chill. I love that. And that's what you need to be a great golfer, as you know. So you had a sponsor exemption at the LPGA Palos Verdes event, and you made the cut. That was your first LPGA tour start, which was exciting. So what, two shots outside the cut line, and you get to the 16th tee. Take us from there.
There were definitely a lot of nerves. I probably haven't felt like those nerves, like I didn't even feel those nerves at Augusta. So, I mean, going into the week, I put pressure on myself to make the cut, and that was definitely like my goal. So, I think I knew like going into the back nine that I was going to have to do something to make the cut. And so when I got to 16, it was a pretty good eagle opportunity. And I was like, okay, I gotta make this putt. And I made that one. And then I had a bit of momentum going into those last two holes. And then I went birdie par. So I think that was a huge accomplishment, I would say.
On 16, you dropped a 40-footer for eagle. Unbelievable. What were you thinking when you were standing over that putt?
No, I knew it was going to go in. I was standing over it. I was like, this has to go in. So I think that was super cool.
It was so cool. And then you get to 17, as you say, you birdied that. You parred the 18th, and then what was the whole experience like for you?
It was obviously like what like anyone expects it to be. I mean, playing in a LPGA event at 16 is super cool. I didn't think I was gonna play at an event that young. So I don't know. It's super fun, and the environment is super fun, and seeing all those pros out there, it's fun to be able to play alongside them.
So now, this week, we have the Conexant Founders Cup, and you have a sponsor exemption here. We're at Upper Montclair Country Club, which is just a classic golf course. It's a Tillinghast design. I know Robert Trent Jones Sr. came in years ago and renovated it. But what about this golf course? Have you had a chance to look at it yet? Do you know anything about it?
No, I kind of just like walked onto the property, but it looks very pretty. It's very green. We don't get that much in San Diego. My course isn't this green and pretty, so I'm looking forward to playing it though.
And it's only May. Wait till June and July in this area. Then things really are beautiful, green, and everything's out. But what have you heard about, you know, the Founders Cup and the fact that this tournament honors the LPGA's 13 founding members?
I think it's cool. A few weeks ago, I talked to Mr. Wood about it, and they're kind of trying to, like, mirror this event with, like, the players, and it's almost like a major event. It's a super important event. So I think it's so cool that the 13 founders have kind of set, like, the path for us, for the youth. And so I think it's cool to be able to continue on that legacy.
Have you thought about turning pro, or you want to continue as an amateur? What are your immediate plans in that regard?
I'm not really sure. I still have 2 years to decide where to go to college or if I want to go to college. So we'll see how the recruiting process takes place in the next few months and how I play in the next like upcoming LPGA events. So I guess I'll decide from there and see what happens.
Yeah, we forget you're only 16 years old, right? you're what, a sophomore in high school? Oh my gosh, and you don't have your driver's license yet.
I know. We're working on it though. We're working on it.
So, you know, it's easy to kind of look ahead, but you have your whole like high school life to live, and then do you want to go to college?
I'm not really sure. As I said, I have like 2 years and anything can happen in those 2 years. So I don't really want to make a decision now on what I want to do. But I don't know. We'll see what happens. We're kind of just leaving it out there to see what happens.
So now will you be wearing your famous bucket hat at the Founders Cup this coming week?
Yeah, I might make a few appearances in a bucket hat, but we'll see. We'll see on the weather. It depends.
You made that apparel part of your, you know, kind of a new thing. It's a big statement now, so I think more and more people are going to be wearing bucket hats.
Yeah, I've gotten like, I have one of our family friends is like the merchandise person at Ponte Vedra Inn and Club, and that was like the bucket hat I was wearing at Augusta, like the seahorse logo. And she texted me and she's like, our bucket hat sales are like through the roof. And some of the people at home were like, yeah, like the amount of bucket hats I've sold this week is actually insane. Like the week after Augusta. So I think it's kind of cool. It's kind of funny.
That's not fun. See the influence you have already after winning the Augusta National Women's Am. So talk about your golf background. When did you start playing, Anna? Who exposed you to the game, and if you have a coach?
When I was younger, like 3 or 4, I like grew up playing golf. It's kind of all I've ever known. And I have a twin brother. His name is Billy. And we've grown up playing golf together. And I think that's been an advantage in my game, I would say, growing up with him and us being able to compete against each other. And we've always been super competitive, especially when we were younger. But I think growing up with him and always having like somebody to feed off of and having like a companion with you all the time when you're playing, that's always been super important. And my golf coach is Bill Barrett. I've been seeing him for like as long as I can remember, so he knows my swing very well.
And he is from your hometown in California?
He is, yes, yeah.
You have a twin brother who plays golf, so is it still very competitive when you two go out and play matches against each other?
Yeah, it always is. He hits it. I mean, I used to hit it farther than him, and then he had a growth spurt. Now he hits it farther than me, which is, it's a little unfair when we play, I would say, but it's okay. I still beat him. It's all right.
So there's a little sibling, twin sibling rivalry, which probably is a little more intense than your normal sibling rivalry, right? So he used to beat you. Now you beat him, or is it?
No, it's always like back and forth. I think I'd say we're like about the same skill level, and we always have been like growing up. So it's always back and forth when we play matches.
So I understand you're going to Pine Valley, and you're going to play the exclusive Pine Valley. That's real exciting.
No, it is super exciting. I'm looking forward to it this coming Tuesday. So that'll be fun to play a course that's ranked ahead of Augusta.
Exactly. Oh, my gosh. So Augusta National, you win it, the Women's Am. And was that the first time you played it? I know you played it the day before with the practice round, right? So was that the very first time you had played Augusta National? I guess it's 16. How many times are you going to play Augusta National?
Yeah, that was my first time. I played like the practice round the day before, and you can't really see it like on TV, but like the undulations are insane, like the elevation changes, and it's a lot more open than it looks on TV, but the crowds make it look so much smaller than it is. So I was going into the tournament thinking that the fairway was going to be super narrow, but like you can really miss it anywhere. There's just a bunch of people everywhere.
I love it. So Pine Valley's on your agenda. What else are you going to be doing this summer?
I get to play in three majors. So I get to play the U.S. Open, the Evian, and the British Open. So I'm looking forward to going overseas and playing. That'll be like my first time going overseas. So I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Wow. So how do you kind of handle all these experiences? You're going to play in the three major championships, which is incredible. You're playing in these LPGA Tour events, but you seem to be as calm and relaxed as ever.
I mean, I knew it was going to happen eventually. It's definitely surprising that it's happening like at this young of an age. But to have these experiences is super cool, and I'm honestly just really looking forward to what's to come and what's going to happen after those LPGA events, so we'll see.
And is there any one player? We heard Stacey Lewis today at the media day here at the Founders Cup. She's amazing, right? She's going to be captaining the Solheim Cup team, the next one. But is there any player or players on tour that you kind of look up to or have gotten to know that have made an influence on you and your game?
The two girls that I've always enjoyed watching are the Korda sisters. I think we're pretty like similar in how we play. They're just very poised on the golf course. And so I always enjoy watching them. They're good role models.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Anna, and continued success. Keep having fun, right? Keep smiling. As Nancy Lopez said, play happy golf, right? Don't let any of the pressure, the expectations kind of, you know, deter you from just having fun and enjoying what you're doing.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And she's right. Definitely try to relax on the golf course for sure.
Great advice. Anna Davis, thanks for being on Talking Golf. Such an extraordinary 16-year-old, Anna Davis, right? Gosh, she really is chill. So much fun to talk to her. All right, coming up, Jeff Hall of the USGA shares some of the compelling history of the country club in Brookline, Massachusetts, site of the U.S. Open, June 16th through the 19th.
It's Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori on The Fan.
Welcome back to Talking Golf with Ann Liguori, and it is my pleasure to say hello to Jeff Hall, the USGA Championship Director of Inside the Ropes Activities for the U.S. Open, which is quickly approaching June 16th through the 19th at the Country Club in Brookline, Massachusetts. Jeff, welcome to Talking Golf.
Well, thank you, Ann. Really excited to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
And talking about a rich history, oh my goodness, the Country Club. We were there last Monday for the U.S. Open Media Day, experienced the clubhouse, the golf course. I was there in 1999 to cover the Ryder Cup. It's just one of these historic meccas in golf.
Yeah, I think as you make a turn off of Clyde Street into the driveway, and you proceed down the drive, you cross over the 15th hole and you see that stately clubhouse. You just know you're at a very special place in golf, and the history here at the Country Club, you know, it goes back to being one of the founding clubs of the USGA. And then that history grows from there with the championship golf across so many decades, with obviously perhaps the most important U.S. Open ever played in 1913 that Francis, we met one and put golf on the front page of the New York Times is pretty spectacular.
I just love all that history. The Country Club, one of the five founding member clubs, as you say, back in 1894, joining Newport Country Club, Chicago Golf Club, Shinnecock in my neck of the woods, St. Andrews Golf Club in Westchester County. And it just doesn't get more historic than that when it comes to golf in our country.
No, absolutely. And the reason that these clubs got together and founded the USGA was twofold at that time. It was to codify the rules of golf so that there was one set of rules that we all could play by, and to run championships and national championships. And we've been in that business since 1894, 1895, our first championships, first three championships were the U.S. Amateur, followed by the Women's Amateur, and then the U.S. Open was an afterthought, but it was the third championship that we conducted in 1895. So we've been involved in the professional game, the amateur game, the women's game since our inception.
And you're so passionate about talking about the history. When you were talking last Monday at the US Open Media Day, you could see the passion that you have for history and for, you know, the Country Club and its part in history. And I know the Country Club has hosted three previous US Opens and is where one of the greatest upsets in sports happened, when Francis Ouimet, who you spoke about, 20 years old, an amateur, beat Harry Vardon and Ted Ray to win the championship in that 18-hole playoff. And what's cool is every time you play the course, you know, they point out Francis Ouimet's house. He lived literally, he was a caddy at the Country Club. He lived literally across the street from the golf course.
Exactly. Again, one of the maybe the most important moment in American golf. I think it helped popularize the game in the country at that time. As I said, it put it on the front page of all the papers in our country, and it really got the ball rolling. Perhaps not in the same way that COVID has got golf back to being popular again, but it's at that point in time, it was just an instrumental championship for popularizing the game, and certainly a very special moment here at the Country Club. And of course, you mentioned the other opens as well. All three U.S. Opens here ended with a playoff. I don't know what that tells us for 2022, but.
That's right. And well, let's talk about the golf course and how will the golf course play differently than the 1988 U.S. Open when Curtis Strange won in a playoff.
The fourth hole of the main course that was used in 1988, we will not be using. It's actually going to be used as part of the broadcast compound. And we've added what will be the 11th hole for the U.S. Open routing, which is a fantastic little short par three, 130 yards. And incidentally, the fourth hole is about a 330-yard par four that we won't be using. So that And I share that because that shifts par from 71 in 1988 to 70. And overall, with the restorative work that Gil Hance did here working with the Country Club, we've also added about 250 yards. Well, wait, the club has added about 250 yards to their golf course. A bit of a modernization, if you will, with respect to the way the game is played today. So a few changes. But again, the majority of the holes that everybody will see and may recall from 1988 will be presented and to the game's best players in the 122nd U.S. Open.
So, Jeff, now the course, it's not long, you know, compared to a lot of other U.S. Open venues, right? 7,264 yards, as you say, it's going to play to a par 70 this year. These guys average, 295 yards off the tee average, maybe even more. So how do you think the distance will come into play for these incredibly long hitters?
Well, that's a really interesting question, Anne. And I think, as I said on Monday, I am fascinated to see how the modern golfer is going to attack this golf course. I think there will be some holes where they will do just that. They'll get driver and get after it and bang it down there as far as they can. But I think with the way the golf course, when this golf course was built, you had to fit it into the land that was there. You didn't change the land to build the hole. You fit the hole into the land. And as a result, there are some land on a few holes. The third hole is an example. The ninth hole is an example where I think there will be some thought involved from a player's standpoint of maybe I'll lay back here and have a better look at the hole, a better lie as far as being more level than, or just, I'm not going to take on that risk. What's the real upside of driving it into the fescue here if I hit a poor tee shot? So it'll be fascinating to see how that works out. But I think there'll be a number of holes. There's a good mix of holes here at the Country Club. There's a number of very short holes. There's some very long par fours. The 15th hole, as an example, is 515 yards as a par four. The 14th hole, 619 yard par five. That, again, when you look at the number, you say, well, in the modern day, they can still reach it. Maybe if they drive it in the fairway, a plateau, they won't really be able to see precisely where they're going. And it's going to be fascinating to see how the modern golfer attacks this golf course. But yes, it's a number of holes where connecting the dots may be the right way to play, as opposed to just how far can I hit it and give me the shortest second shot that's available.
Sure. The premium could be obviously accuracy off the tee. And then your short game and putting, I mean, those greens are small, Jeff.
Very small. And as far as our setup strategy, we are trying to make sure that players, you heard John Bonehammer the other day talk about, hey, let's get every club dirty. That would be ideal. If they get all 14 clubs dirty over the course of the four rounds, that would be fantastic. Or at least as many of them as possible dirty. The greens are tiny. And so that target is small. The fairways are narrow in spots, a little more generous in some other spots. But I can assure you, just based on going around the golf course the last few days and looking at things as we prepare, the rough is ready. We just need a little bit of 70-degree weather. And, we'll be losing small children and dogs in this rough. It's going to be thick. And that's what it's supposed to be, a premium on driving the golf ball in the fairway. You want to try to drive it down there and you're not successful and it's in the rough, I think you're going to have some challenge moving the ball out of that rough. But the greens are small. And if we get fortunate with the weather where it's dry and firm and the players have to contemplate what happens to the golf ball when it gets on the ground, both in the fairway and on the putting green, that makes all the difference in the world.
I don't believe me. I experienced that rough firsthand playing in media day last Monday. You do not want to get anywhere near that rough. And it was fun because, as I said, I was there at the Country Club in Brookline back in 1999 to cover the Ryder Cup for WFAN. And, we were standing on that 17th green and just visualizing that putt that Justin Leonard sunk from 40 feet for birdie, which really clinched it for the U.S. team. So there's just so much history at the Country Club, Jeff. What about the clubhouse? What can you tell us about the clubhouse? Because just so many cool nuances of the historic clubhouse.
How about a clubhouse and a club that's got so much rich tradition in golf? And it seems like on many walls, you see pictures of horses and steeplechase everywhere. And that's obviously part of the history of this club and the racetrack that was here. They really, most of the initial activities at the country club were equine in nature, and the playoff holes for the U.S. Open are going to be the first and 18th hole, which were fit inside that racetrack when it existed here at the club. So who knows, they'll be racing around for the U.S. Open title, but there's just so much history. And I know you heard some of this on Monday, but the cathedrals of the game, the country club is one of the cathedrals of the game, not just out on the golf course, but that stately clubhouse. And as it sits on that hill and looks over the 18th green, and, you know, the ghosts of the past, they'll be there with us as this championship unfolds in June. And it's exciting to come to a place like this. As you traverse the golf course and you stand on these tees and look out at that golf hole, you just know you're looking at a U.S. Open golf course. And it's pretty exciting.
So for the folks at home, what does it mean to be the championship director of Inside the Ropes activities?
Well, every day I am charged with thinking about the U.S. Open and not much else. And Inside the Ropes, we define our responsibilities and our activities to inside and outside the ropes. So Inside the Ropes is all about golf course preparation, presentation, and the overall conduct of the championship. I participate with many others. Listen, this is not a one-man operation. There's a great team of us that are involved with setup and how high are we going to grow the grass? How often are we going to cut the grass? How much water are we going to put out on the golf course? And just working through all of that with our operations people, as far as, hey, we got to get the fans off the golf course, move them back to the parking lots. We've got to then work with ground staff, and we got to get water off the golf course. And hey, now we've got a full golf course, and the next morning at 7 a.m., we need to get started. Television's coming on the air, working through where we spot the television cameras. We went through that with NBC last fall. So those are some of the things that I'm involved with. But if I certainly want to make sure that everybody understands, it's while I may think about all this stuff every day, there are many very talented, capable people that I work with and alongside to execute all of those things.
Do you feel any pressure? Because a lot of times, you know, players and perhaps members in the media will criticize how the course is set up. They didn't water the greens enough, watered it too much. It's too easy. It's too difficult. I mean, it's hard to please everybody, right?
Yeah, I don't think that that's possible. And August will be 32 years with USGA. Not that I've been in this particular role for all 32 of those years, but I learned long ago that you better have thick skin with this. And I what we have found with the players, especially in recent years, you know, Jason Gore came onto our staff and as our managing director of player relations. And it's really allowed the players to have a voice and a conduit into the USGA to talk about things. And we're talking with players. And what we've really found, and John Bodenhammer has really instilled this in all of us, you need to be able to explain the why. And when you can have a reasonable conversation and explain the why, reasonable people can disagree. That's okay. As we said a moment ago, you can't please everyone, but we can have a discussion as to the why and provide some thinking as to the why. And then oftentimes, again, you may not change somebody's point of view, but at least there's an understanding and a respect for that point of view. We may differ on it, but there's an understanding, and that's all you can ask for. So listen, we won't please everybody. I know there'll be one person who'll be very happy on June 19th when that champion receives the trophy. But I would say a perfect U.S. Open is one that the other 155 players, when they leave the championship, if they say, you know what, it was out there, I just wasn't quite as good this week. I just wasn't quite good enough. It was out there. It was very difficult. That's what the U.S. Open's supposed to be. It's a different week than every other week on tour, but it was fair. And I just didn't quite measure up this week.
Jeff Hall, thank you so much. Really appreciate your insight and looking forward to heading to the Country Club, Brookline, Massachusetts, for one of the most historic venues in the game for the U.S. Open. Thanks so much, Jeff.
All right. Well, the week after the U.S. Open is the Travelers Championship. And coming up in a few minutes, Nathan Grube, the tournament director of the Travelers Championship, he will join us.
It's Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori on The Fan.
Welcome back to Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori. And Nathan Grube, the tournament director, Travelers Championship, joins me now to preview this exciting PGA Tour event in Connecticut, June 23rd to the 26th. Hey, Nathan, welcome to Talking Golf.
And thank you so much for having me on. Whenever I talk to you, I know spring is here, summer's right around the corner, so I'm so excited to talk to you right now.
I know. Hopefully the sun will come out soon, right? And we'll get some warmth. But hey, that was a fun media day last Tuesday.
You know what? It's one of the first ones we've had in like 3 years, actually, where we're all together. And it was very cool. I mean, Harris English, our champion, giving us the time. You know, all the media coming out, giving us the time, playing the golf course. It was just, it was fun to see everybody and, you know, talk stories and get excited for the upcoming Travelers Championship.
And some news that day, of course, if there is another playoff, and last year, as you mentioned, it ended with Harris English winning after a record 8 sudden death playoff holes. We know that Andy Bassett and Travelers CEO Alan Schnitzer will not be wearing wool jackets, right?
I tell you what, listen, that the wool jacket with the red umbrella was a really good idea on paper for like a closing ceremony shot. Not so good for an 80-degree walk for 2 hours. So, you know, some things on paper look really good, but then they've decided they're taking the wool coats off next year if we have a playoff, which I think we have a playoff like every other year is what it comes down to. But they're going to be wearing golf shirts this time.
What are your memories of that 8-hole playoff from last year?
I mean, as a tournament director, you think about the weather first, right? Like, okay, is everything going to be good? And the weather was perfect that afternoon. And then to have the crowd so excited, they were running back and forth from 18 to 17 and, you know, doing the wave on 18 and chanting Harris and Kramer's name. Like, it was just, there was so much energy and excitement. But honestly, Ann, about the 7th hole, I started to get nervous going, okay, if we run out of daylight, what's our contingency? You know, like you have to have that plan for a Monday finish. So I started talking to our ops team going, all right, you know, let's make sure the committees are set up and security and police and concessions and gate, you know, just kind of going through all those logistics. So I kind of lost the excitement for about 35 to 40 minutes because I really thought there is no way we're going to run out of daylight. You know, it's one of the longest days of the year. I swear we had like 21 hours of daylight that day. But, I mean, it looked like we were about to run out. So I was excited, and then I went into logistics mode, and then I was just really excited when Harris hit that putt to win.
Well, it finally ended at, what, 8:09, right? What time was sundown?
Oh, gosh. We had probably another 15 minutes at the most.
Oh, wow.
I was talking to Gary, the rules official with the PGA Tour, and they're walking up the fairway, and I'm walking behind on the radio, and they're walking up, and he said, Nathan, on the 8th hole, the hole that actually ended it, he goes, we maybe have one more hole, but then we're going to Monday. So I knew, I'm like, man, we have 20 minutes, maybe. So, yeah, it came down to the wire.
Literally, it really did. Well, why do you think we get such dramatic finishes at the Travelers Championship? I mean, guys in the lead falling apart, others coming back from, you know, dramatic deficits to win. Why do you think that's the case there?
I honestly think it has to do with the layout of the course. Layout of the course and the crowds, right? I mean, you've played the golf course. You've seen it when the crowds are there. When you come through 14, right, you kind of finish that par 4 on 14, and you just kind of take this right, and you don't realize it, but you kind of come into this arena of 4 finishing holes that are all right in front of you. The crowds are there. They get loud, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, man, this is real. I remember Stuart Sink said it about it. He said, it's probably 4 of the best finishing holes that we play on tour because everything is right in front of you. And it's so loud. And you, I mean, it's a drivable par 4, a hard par 3, a hard par 4, a loud par 4. So I think guys just kind of start to feel it. And not only that, but you can make a big move one way or the other. I mean, I remember Bubba could have probably won this tournament. He won it 3 times, but he could have won it at least 2 more. And then just had, I mean, some really tough holes on 16 and 17. And I just think it's the atmosphere mixed with the actual layout of the golf course. It's just, it's good theater, and guys can go one way or the other there.
I mean, it's great theater. I know last year, Bubba, as you mentioned, three-time winner of the Travelers, he was in the lead, but then he finished with four bogeys and a double.
It was unreal. So, I mean, I go back to that, right? When they teed off, it was Bubba and Kramer Hickok in that last group that teed off. And everybody was rooting for Bubba, right? I mean, it was going to be potentially his fourth win. He was going to tie Billy Casper. And, I mean, they were chanting Bubba, Bubba on the first tee. And then just what happened with the run that Kramer made in that group. I mean, the crowd, and even Bubba did. He kind of realized what was happening on, like, 17, I would say. So walking up 18, he knew he was out of it. He knew Kramer had a chance for the playoff. And he was right there for Kramer. It was really cool to see Bubba kind of, you know, in the middle of his, you know, really tough stretch of holes, he kind of stepped aside in a sense, like, hey, Kramer, you know, you have a chance to get into the playoff here. So that was pretty cool to see. And then all of a sudden at the end of that round, they're chanting Kramer, Kramer, Kramer when he gets into the playoff. So to see that flip from, you know, when they teed off on one, where the gallery was, you know, chanting for Bubba, and then they were chanting for Kramer. So it was just, it was very cool to see.
And then Ches Reavie, I remember in 2019, he did have a six-shot lead, but then that dissipated to a one-shot lead at one point. He ended up beating Keegan Bradley by a pretty comfortable margin. But, you know, Reavie, six-shot lead, and then it gets down to one.
So that was another one. You're absolutely right. I mean, you go back, we could probably go back each year, but Ches on the back nine, you know, he's like, okay, he's looking comfortable. His stats all week were crazy good. And then Keegan makes that run, right? And Keegan's a New England guy. And all of a sudden, the momentum that Keegan had, and then it was on seven, I think on the 17th tee, to your point, Ches only had a one-shot lead on 17, and Keegan, I think, had just birdied 15. And then the tee shot, Keegan puts in the bunker, and then it just, he makes a double there. I mean, it was just like, it flipped, to your point. Ches ended up winning, I think, by three, I think, if I'm not mistaken. But standing on that 17th tee, you're sitting there going, man, no lead is safe. You just know what's going to happen on this back nine. So that was pretty fun, too.
And then, of course, you can't forget Jordan Spieth holing out from that greenside bunker on the 18th to win in a playoff against Daniel Berger. That happened in 2017. So there's always great theater on those last holes.
It's one of those things where you look at a golf course and it can play into the narrative of your tournament so well, right? There's some courses that kind of have this history as you go into it. You know, it's been here for 100 years and it's hosted Ryder Cups and things like that. There's some courses that kind of bring a history with them. And then there are some courses that just bring the anticipation of drama. Like, and that's what I think we have. Our fans, it's so funny. They go, okay, what's going to happen this year? You know, there's just this anticipation because of the golf course. And I remember in 2016, you brought up the Jordan shot. But in 16, I remember when Furyk shoots 58, you know, and sets the PGA to a record and people are going crazy. I remember somebody coming up to me after that. And they went, man, you are in trouble next year. There's no way you're going to be able to follow this, you know. And it was somebody from the media, and I'm like, oh, gosh, you know, this is going to be tough to do that. And then Jordan chips in the next year, and that person was like, well, okay, I guess you did. You know, so you just kind of never know, but our fans just come to expect it. It's kind of fun.
Well, as you said, Harris English was connected via Zoom at the media day, and he had hip surgery early this year, which, gosh, after such a great season last year, that was too bad. I know he was eligible for the Masters for the first time, but he had to miss the Masters. So what's his status for coming up this season?
You know, talking to Harris and his agent, they both are saying that he feels good. I mean, Harris is really looking forward to you know, he circled, obviously, our event to be able to come back and play. But what's crazy, Ann, is that you heard him say this in media day, that he's been dealing with this injury for like 10-plus years. And he kind of knew that it was coming, and he was kind of making modifications and tweaks in his swing to kind of accommodate for the tear. And then he finally just said, look, it was too much. And to think that a guy knew that he had a tear in his hip, and he still won multiple times that year, played on a Ryder Cup, you know, things like that. It's like, wow, what's he going to do now that this is fixed, if it really has been kind of a lingering injury? So, but yeah, no, he's scheduled to come back, and he wants to be, you know, more than 100% by the time he gets to Travelers.
That'd be awesome. Awesome. Well, let's talk about the stars who are coming along with Harris English. Hopefully he'll be fully recuperated. Rory McIlroy seems to commit very early to play.
So it's funny, these guys, you know this, right? And so your listeners, I'm sure, do as well, that all of these players are independent contractors, right? They don't have to play anywhere. And so, you know, part of our job, you know, with Andy Bissett and myself, you know, we go out and recruit players. So to get the guys to commit early is something that obviously the fans love, that we love. And Rory has been awesome. I mean, since the first time he played here in, I want to say maybe it was 16 or 17 was his first year here. And he said something, he said, you know what? It's like a Ryder Cup that people are actually here at 6:50 in the morning lining the first tee to do it. I'm like, yeah, our fans are great. So he has said, I mean, once he came here, he has said, I absolutely love coming here for all the reasons, and we love having him. But yeah, once he knows, he's one of those guys that once he knows where he's playing, he will say, yeah, I'm coming, and he'll commit early. Other guys wait till the last minute. Just kind of that's their mentality. But Rory has always been really, really good where he knows, I want to say almost a year and a half in advance, like kind of what his schedule is sometimes. And if he knows he's coming, he lets you say, hey, absolutely, talk about me in market. So he's been so helpful.
And you have Brooks Koepka, Patrick Cantlay, Dustin Johnson, Scottie Scheffler, Xander Schauffele, JT, Bubba, Will Zalatoris. I mean, really incredible field.
You know what? I get nervous for the U.S. Open. You know, they have to play before us, and they're nervous about how they're going to get their field in. Obviously, I'm kidding. But, you know, I mean, yeah, with the Open so close, the guys, I think, know their schedule earlier where they're just going to be able to drive down. It's a quick, you know, you did it last week, right? I mean, it's a quick drive. And so, yeah, it's great. I mean, just building relationships with those guys. And it's interesting when you look back, like at the top 10 in the world right now, I mean, you look back like, okay, so many of those guys we have built relationships with and given exemptions to, you know, when they started their career, you look at it, it's like Rahm and Morikawa and Hovland and Cantlay and Justin Thomas. And like all those guys were amateurs or turned pro with us, you know? So kind of that exemption relationship, that story, over the years, getting to know them when they're younger. And then obviously they become, you know, what they've become. It's, you know, they remember and they come back and our fans remember and they appreciate it. So it's kind of that long-term strategy approach that's paying off with the field.
And one of my favorite aspects of the Travelers is that 100% of net proceeds each year donated to nonprofit organizations in the area. And I know last year the Travelers Championship raised $2.2 million for what, 125 charities in the region, which is unbelievable. And since the tournament's inception in 1952, $45.5 million donated.
And it's one of the things I never get tired of talking about. And I think it's the coolest part of the PGA Tour. I mean, the fact that we can say that, like that we, you know, you heard me say it last week, we don't have an owner, right? Like the Travelers Championship doesn't have an owner that sees this as a, you know, a profit line of their portfolio, of their business. Like this tournament exists to be able to raise money for charity. And those numbers kind of roll off the tongue, like, oh, we raised $2.2 million. But, like, there are so many stories that I wish I could sit down with your listeners and be like, all right, now let's talk about the actual people impacted by each of these numbers, where you can run a professional sporting event and do something that, you know, impacts the community, and then you get the best players in the world playing here. But then also, like, these are real people. I mean, you heard the young man speak, say, from Omaha Gang Camp. I mean, these are real people that are impacted significantly by these numbers, and it's happening in every community. Every community where there's a PGA Tour event, this happens. So you're right, it's a super unique aspect of the PGA Tour, and I never get tired of talking about it.
And I love the passion of you and your team for this Travelers Championship, and in particular for all the charity dollars that you raise. I can't thank you enough, Nathan, for getting up early and coming on, and see you at the Travelers Championship, June 23rd to the 26th.
Awesome, Ann. Thank you for all the support. We'll see you soon.
Take care. Have a great day, and happy Mother's Day to everybody. My thanks to Nathan Grube, to Jeff Hall of the USGA, to Anna Davis. Be sure to watch the LPGA Founders Cup this week from Upper Montclair Country Club in Clifton, New Jersey. My thanks to Ed Arzuman in the studio. Hey, next Sunday, we'll preview the PGA Championship. We'll talk about Phil Mickelson. So much news there. Talking Golf with Ann Liguori was brought to you by Travelers. It's better under the umbrella. Stay tuned for Rick Wolf and the Sports Edge. And I look forward to catching up with you next Sunday morning from 7 to 8, right here on Talking Golf with Ann Liguori.